actually makes it worse. James Thomas and his team are working on virtual reality games that seduce users into exercising their pain points. Here they are with a pain patient playing virtual reality tennis.
Load screen is not up in there, is it?
No.
Okay.
All right, here you go.
All right, I need to go full Jimmy Connors on me.
That's James Thomas. He leads a team at Virginia Commonwealth University's Motor Control Lab, and he's a professor in the Department of Physical Therapy. James, what led you to think of using virtual reality for people with back pain?
Well, I've been a clinician for a lot of years, and before going into research, ended up looking at a certain aspect of pain and fear of pain and how it influenced how people moved. And we were trying to come up with a clever idea of how we could engage. We really started in a very, virtual reality in the most basic manner. We were playing, our original game was played on a 3D TV with shutter goggles. And then the introduction of the Oculus Rift 2, the headset, the fully immersive, we just said we got to jump in right away.
What do you mean about people with back pain having fear? What were you trying to get them past?
Yeah, so there's a lot of work that people have looked at that people who have sort of high fear of movement generally think that my back is hurt, and if I move, I'm going to really be hurt and it's going to be permanent.
Yeah.
And so what people tend to do is there's the whole fear avoidance model of back pain that was developed. We actually were one of the first labs to say, okay, how do these fears actually play out with people with back pain? So that was the whole rationale, was how do we get people to overcome this fear and to engage in movement?
Do you want people with back pain really to move? I mean, shouldn't they not move?
No. The old adage, to rest is to rust. But it really is problematic that people don't engage in movements. Let's say that you're worried about hurting your back. In the early stages, like when it's first injured and really inflamed, yeah, a little bit of rest. But as you start to recover, let's say you start to avoid certain areas, like you don't like to bend forward. And so you avoid bending forward and you change your movement patterns to avoid that. Now let's say that all of a sudden you're walking along and you've got a bag of groceries and you step down off a curb and the bag shifts a little bit. And now you're forced to bend forward.
Right.
Well, now you have to move in an area which your body isn't used to. You're stretching tissues that are shortened. Your muscular reactions are going to be delayed, and then you're going to exacerbate your condition, which is then reinforces this construct, oh, I shouldn't move because it'll make me worse, and it spirals downhill.
So you can take a person with a painful back condition who you need to get up and moving in a certain way to be healthier, and this is helped by putting a virtual reality headset on and lashing out with the body?
Well, yeah, and it's a little bit more than that. We created the game of dodgeball, virtual version of it, right? So it's a game that everybody knows. And what happens is that I can adjust the trajectory where that ball is going to hit you. Is it going to hit you in the head, in the chest, in the knees, or the ankles?
Right.
And by doing that, I can get you to move and move progressively further.
Yeah.
And then I can adjust how fast the balls are launched at you. So the faster the balls are launched, the quicker you have to get there, which means not only do you have to move a certain amount, but then you also have to move that amount quickly. So the actual loading or forces that you have to generate go up. So we start it real easy, high arcing balls that are coming at you, they're easy to intercept, and then we progress the game so that it's more and more difficult as you're progressing through the intervention.
You have another game I love that involves swatting at attacking sharks. Tell me about that one.
So our dodgeball game is called Dodgeality, and then we have Fishality, which is a fishing game. And essentially, you're on an idyllic lake, and this is one of our easier games because you see the fish swim up, they jump in a nice high arcing fashion, and then they come in and you reach out your net to try to grab them. Again, we can change where the fish virtual fish are going to launch and land so we can get you to move in any direction we want you. Well, part of any game is you have to have elements that surprise and sometimes terrify. And so there is this thing where you'll hear a bit of the soundtrack from Jaws, and then all of a sudden a shark will leap out of this pond. It makes no sense. You're on a pond in the, you know, thing, but all of a sudden this giant, you know, great white is coming at right for your head. And to successfully do it, you're supposed to duck out of the way of the shark and let it pass over. But a lot of people entertain and like to smack it with the net, which then causes the shark to fly away.
So much of this is distracting them in a pleasurable way that deeply engages them. And then they're actually going through the body motions you need them to make to heal.
Yes, that's precise. And we, you know, in part of the distraction is we also engage the competitive nature. Right. So every game has a score and you're keeping score, and there are, you know, small monetary amounts that, you know, for each successful block ball, you know, five extra cents. If you get hit, 5 cents gets taken away. So there's some sense of, oh, I don't want to just stand here and get hit. I want to engage.
Oh, I could totally see this being used not only in gyms, but also in physical therapy setups?
Yes. The idea is that there will be versions that would be in the clinic for evaluation, for treatment, and then ultimately in the homes. I'd like to be able to have this so that folks can put the headset on, engage in the process, and then if, you know, we think next generation, we want to say, all right, the healthcare professional can make adjustments to the settings to make sure they're getting what they need. We're also starting to work with a colleague down at New York University developing an artificial intelligence smart learning system that will adapt the game on the fly to the individual.
Why is this better than a game they can just play that already exists off the shelf on their Wii, like Dance Dance Revolution or some sort of tennis or golf game?
Sure, those are interesting games, but they don't scale to the individual. So our games are designed, so I'm 6'2". If someone's 5'2" or 7'2", our games will adjust specifically to your height to ensure that we are getting a specific type of movement. All of our games are then tailored on, okay, we want you to move in such and such a way. We're going to make adjustments in where the ball is launched, how fast it's launched. In these over-the-shelf games, there's some benefit to them, the Wii and such, but they're basically having you move around without any specific purpose.
Any downside to one of these games?
There's potential downside in one of the challenges in VR is this idea of motion sickness. If you move your head and rotate your head to the right 2 degrees at 2 degrees per second, the scene in front of you needs to rotate to the left at 2 degrees per second. If that's off at all, you'll start to feel a little queasy.
Oh.
So the classic example to use this knowledge is Disney and the rides at Disney World. So where there's visual components and there's motion, the frame or the alignment of the visual stimuli to the motion is off by maybe a frame or two. They know that that will make most people feel a little queasy. And that way you feel like you've had your money's worth for a particular ride. If you get off a ride, you don't feel a little like, ooh, you don't think you've got, you know, your money's worth. And so that's a classic setup for amusement parks. And they, you know, it's well known that, you know, that this is what happens. And then when you come off the ride, you come through a quick blast of cold air, and then it realigns the vestibular system with your ocular system. So your eyes and your ears are now realigned and telling you the same thing.
That's so interesting. I had no idea Disney did that on purpose. You know, these days, so much of the actual gaming experience online is with players around the world. Could you imagine that happening with your patients, that they would actually game with each other?
Ultimately, that's one of the ways, you know, when we talk about developing some of our games, is right now you're playing dodgeball against some avatars. If we can get people and develop our next generation of gaming where the actual work is you could be sitting there saying, I could be playing with different folks across Richmond with back pain. I could be working with people across the country or across the world. And particularly, you know, beyond back pain, which is somewhat ubiquitous, right? You know, it's hard not to throw a rock and hit someone who hasn't had back pain.
Right.
But something like Parkinson's disease, which is a much smaller number and the community is smaller, when we get things completely cloud-based, that individuals in Richmond could be playing people in Florence. And you get a number of things beyond just the movement, is you do get social engagement, which, again, given the pandemic and the different elements, people feel closed in. And that only gets exacerbated with aging and various disease states.
James Thomas is a professor in Virginia Commonwealth University's Department of Physical Therapy. To many parents, video gaming is the opposite of learning, but that's not the case in Jacob Enfield's classes. He says gaming makes the struggle of learning more rewarding, and it can keep students from giving up on difficult subjects. Jacob Enfield is a professor of game design at George Mason University. Jacob, so many parents fear that gaming is not actual learning. What do you say to that fear that games in the classrooms are really cheating?
If you are learning, does it matter? I mean, does it really matter how that learning occurs? Like if there's a shortcut and students actually learn, then it's just a teaching strategy. It's just a learning strategy. You know, there are a lot of games that are for entertainment, but even with those games that are designed for entertainment, students learn way more than other activities they might be doing. The amount of information that people, that players have to kind of consume and analyze to be effective in some of these games is ridiculous. I know I saw a video recently about the World of Warcraft. That was like the second largest wiki in existence because the world was so expansive. And so, you know, there's plenty to learn in games. And that's just the entertainment games. So if they're designed for learning, then you've got all kinds of new possibilities.
You started using a game in the classroom for the first time when you were teaching a small class of Spanish-speaking students, and you spoke no Spanish.
Yeah, that was an experience. It was also interesting because I was teaching algebra in a computer science classroom. So really, the computers and the technology became a way to help me communicate with the students. It was a really fun class. It is my favorite class of all time to date. They were wonderful kids.
Right.
And the communication wasn't as big of a factor as you might have thought. But one of the games I did develop was to kind of focus on the mathematics and where they were at in their mathematics, their current ability levels, but at the same time kind of address that language issue. So in the game, it was partly language learning, learning the numbers and the terms for addition and subtraction and the vocabulary of mathematics in English.
What game did you develop for them?
Well, when I developed it for them, it was called Mucho Math. You know, I ended up changing the name of it to Mental Math because besides the language, you know, they're learning mathematics and specifically they're learning how to do math in their head.
Could you tell that they were really getting it?
Well, yeah, that's one of the nice things about a well-designed game is if the gameplay is well-aligned with learning objectives, then they can't proceed in the game. They can't progress. They can't level up without getting it. And I think the classic way to design a game is, you know, you have a pretest, you have the students play the game, you have a post-test, and hopefully they've learned what they need to learn. But then once you know that the learning is happening, you don't need a test. Right? The game itself is the test. They progress through the game and that shows that they are learning. They are applying the concepts in the way that they need to apply them.
Describe Mucho Math for me. What did they have to do that kept them engaged?
The game included activities that involved them trying to get the cheese out of the room. They had to kind of navigate through using angles and get back before a cat could get them. One of them was, it was called fish food. And the fish would swim around and try to eat the other fish, which had numbers on them of what they were aiming for. Maybe even numbers, maybe multiples of three, maybe prime numbers, whatever the level was. So it was a more of an identification. Can students identify the correct thing? If they ate the wrong fish, well, they wouldn't eat the fish. The fish would eat them. And that would be the end of the game or the end of the level.
You said you loved that class and those students so much, even though you all had a language barrier. Why was it?
The students were genuinely passionate about learning and happy to be in school. It was refreshing. And they were excited to come to my class. They had a little 1 minute game they did every day right when they walked in, which is like just trying to improve their best performance. And they liked, I don't know exactly what they liked exactly, but they felt so comfortable with me and the class that on my birthday, they brought me out of the room. They set up a whole bunch of stuff in the room, set up a cake, brought me back in blindfolded, and then shoved my face into the cake. And, you know, I was like, I don't think most students would trust that I would not get upset or that something negative would, like, they just trusted me. They felt comfortable, and it was like a family almost. They reached out to me years after. I just really liked those students.
It's such a joy to hear you describe that. Weren't there already other math games, so many of them out there, that you could have given them rather than designing your own?
There's a lot of poorly designed serious games that don't focus on the learning objectives. I've seen games where just quiz questions pop up, and if you answer them right, you score a goal. If you answer them wrong, the other team scores a goal, and students can see right through that immediately.
So with poor games, what are some of the criticisms of using games in the classroom when they don't work?
Yeah, so drill and practice is one of the criticisms. It's saying that, hey, these games are great at letting people just try something over and over and over and over and over and over, which, by the way, is great because they get instant feedback. And I think that games are great for drill and practice. But there's people who criticize them for saying, well, you're not really getting to the deeper levels of learning, to analysis and synthesis. And to that, I would just say, well, that's because you're looking at games that are focused on drill and practice. And I think that there's a place for those. But there are a lot of other games that do require deeper analysis and synthesis. As an example, I just recently saw a game, a mechanical engineer developed a game where the students had to do the math that would bring a spaceship down to land on a platform, but it had to go fast enough to get past the closing gate and slow enough that it wouldn't crash and get demolished at the bottom. And there was a very slim threshold of, like, they had to be basically perfect. And every time they played the game, the mass of the ship changed and different things changed. So they couldn't just try and try and try and get lucky finally.
You know, as I hear you say that, I relate to my own experience. I never felt like I was quite caught up in math classes. I just didn't have yesterday's basic lesson. It would have been so much better if somehow I could have privately caught up on the principles through games.
Yeah, so math is a great example of where we are falling short in our education system because of this system that we have of grading. And so imagine, you know, starting math in second grade or I don't know, wherever it really gets going. I was a middle school and high school teacher. But imagine passing the class with 70%. So you have this 30% gap of things you didn't really understand, not to mention what you did understand, but kind of faded away over time. And then the next year, you have another 70, 80%, you know, or maybe you even get 90%. Right? But you still have a 10% gap. So over the years, this gap gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And so, yeah, everybody's going to feel like math is hard because they have so many gaps. But in game-based learning and really just mastery learning in general, there are no gaps. Students don't get to move forward until they understand the concept, right? They move at their own pace. And so for me, the most exciting thing about game-based learning is how well it aligns with mastery learning. I recently taught at a school with a computer science program where they got rid of grades altogether. They had mastery learning, and you kept track of their achievements and what they've learned and what they haven't learned yet. And then what goes in their transcript is kind of a a visualization of that. You know, the high school was working with colleges to accept that in their as part of their transcript. So that's always an issue is, well, the colleges need to know what the GPA is of students. So, you know, you have to work around this kind of grade-based system that we have, which I know I've heard in your other previous episodes, people talking about the education system as a sorting mechanism to figure out who are the best and the next best. But that's not what learning needs to be these days, right?
Do you think that gaming will be the norm in classrooms in the near future?
I think it's the norm for some classrooms already. And when I say norm, I mean it happens regularly. Sometimes it's gamified things, like Kahoot is a really popular thing in schools. And that, again, it kind of creates a little competition, Jeopardy-type feel for kind of going over information. But I think as far as getting games for learning, like sitting behind a desk or sitting on your mobile phone and playing these games, I don't really see that as being in the classroom. I see it more of a flipped classroom that teachers might assign it. Hopefully, I would see them assigning it and then using the classroom time to debrief. One of the most important things with learning through games is debriefing. There's been research that shows that without debriefing, you're going to have all kinds of issues with learning. Specifically, you're going to have misconceptions. You're going to learn things that were unintended. As an example, you're playing a math game and they are supposed to learn XYZ, but they end up learning shortcuts or other ways to beat the game or other ways to progress through the game, and they didn't actually learn what you expected them to. Well, you don't know that unless you have some type of debriefing session.
How hard is it for teachers to find the best games and not waste their time on the bad ones? Are we giving teachers at every level the top games out there so they don't waste time and students' time?
Yeah, I think that there is no central repository for finding good quality games that I know of. You know, you hear about a game, you try it with your students, it's word of mouth. And, you know, to some extent, that might be the best approach. That way, the only games that really get to be successful are those that teachers really appreciate and enjoy. Yeah, I don't know. I've never thought about it too much other than I've always struggled to find the game that I would want my students to play. So I've oftentimes made the game I want my students to play.
Well, Jacob Enfield, thank you for talking with me and with good reason.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Jacob Enfield is a professor of gaming theory at George Mason University. Support for With Good Reason is provided by the University of Virginia Health System, a National Cancer Institute designated cancer center, researching and developing the treatments of tomorrow, uvahealth.com. Virginia Humanities has a new paid fellowship opportunity for humanities scholars affiliated with Virginia's historically black colleges and universities. Selected candidates will be funded through a grant from Dominion Energy Charitable Foundation. Applications are due by January 7th. For more, go to virginiahumanities.org. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Maya Neer and Cassandra Deering are our interns. For the podcast, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening. Stress.
We'll be right back. Portland.
Our goal is to create an atmosphere devoid of genre. A place where quality is key. It's important for the world and future generations to understand the power of art and music. Ultimately, we are doing our part to carry on tradition. Tune into Passing Sound, the first